Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Honeycomb Credit. Heritage Radio Network listeners can learn more about the power of community capital by visiting honeycombcredit.com/HRN.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. It's a better egg made from plants. Bring more customers in your doors with Just Egg. Start with a free sample at ju.st/HRN.
This week on Meet and Three, we dedicate our stories to elders, grandparents, and family members who came before us.
Some people called on the phone. What time is your appointment? Mine's 2:45. Our friend, the dentist, he was 3:30. And it was like a social event.
It's a small island. A lot of them I knew when I was a kid. So it was, you know, to really help them feel like they weren't alone.
It's partly this communal nature of food, and so it can operate as a bridge, not just between neighbors and friends, but also between the living and the dead.
Listen to Meet and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. I'm your host, Aaron Sanchez, alongside my lovely mother,
Sarera Martinez.
Well, we are very excited to have all of you guys listening and tuning in. We're inviting someone that I consider my tia, my aunt. She is an amazing woman that I've known since I was a young boy. She is an unbelievable resource for all things food. Of course, we're talking about Anne Mendelsohn. And Anne is a writer and a culinary historian. She has co-authored 3 books with my mother.
And we still talk.
And we guys still talk, obviously. She's my mom's co-writer from her all 3 books, Food from My Heart, The Food and Life of Oaxaca, and Salelas Veracruz. She's a dear friend of my mom, as you can imagine. She began her culinary career as a cookbook reviewer for Bon App. And she later became a staff editor at Cuisine and served as a contributing editor at Gourmet as well. So she comes with so much great knowledge and background, and she is, I just think, someone that's an unbelievable resource. And she's just lovely, and I'm so excited. I know my mom and I are so excited to have Anne back with us. Thank you so much, Anne. And today we're going to be covering a subject that is near and dear to my mom and all 3 of us, which is the idea of lard and other cooking fats. I think we should rename this episode, Mom, Praise the Lard, right?
Yeah, like the article.
Yes, and which is the article that I'm sure you will cover as we go into it. So let's welcome Anne.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here. I just came across that article again. The other day, that Praise the Lord article in the LA Times.
Yes. Well, that's how I got into this whole subject of lard, because Ruth Rachel called me to write an article about lard. And so I started doing all this research and became fascinated with it, because, I mean, lard was an everyday thing for me. It wasn't like a very special thing. And I remember that I was talking to everybody, and I talked to Kurt Vonnegut, you know, the author. And he said that everybody was making such a big deal about eating food with lard. He said, isn't it funny how people who would never touch something like that make such a big deal about it? You know, and it's true. That's how I started the article, in any case. But this is a wonderful subject.
And let's talk a little bit about lard and how it's been used over history, why it's such an important fat. So we'll talk a little bit about its health properties, because I know it's this big misnomer that lard is bad for you, as opposed to other kinds of cooking fats or cooking medium. So I'd be interested, so if we can touch a little bit about some of its history, how it was initially used, how it's made culturally, and how it affects Mexican cuisine as well.
So Anne would be the perfect person to do this.
Well, I would like to start out by pointing out some things that, well, Sarah and Aaron know this, but a lot of Mexican food lovers probably don't. When the Spanish invaders, when the invaders got to Mexico, the indigenous people were not cooking with lard. Not only that, they used absolutely no cooking fats. They did not fry. They did not sauté. They didn't put any extraneous fat in the food at all. But this doesn't mean it was a fat-free diet, because there are so many foods that are naturally rich in fats. Just think about avocados. Think about chocolate, which they used as a beverage, of course.
Coconut?
Yeah, well, there were these various, yes, these various sources of natural fat. And so the Aztecs, the Maya, the other indigenous peoples, they were not deprived. They had a very rich diet. But the Spanish arrived thinking, you know, what is the matter with these people? How can anybody be so dumb not to cook with lard or with butter or with olive oil? And the peoples in Mexico thought, how can the Spanish be so dumb to cook with these horrible tasting things? Because they found them very, very distasteful. We all know that that changed. But there was no pre-Hispanic history of lard or any other cooking fat.
Well, plenty of colonial time.
So the Spanish got to every part of what they called New Spain, and they write back and they tell the king back in Madrid, here is this land that is perfect for growing all kinds of wonderful old world crops, olives, wine grapes, wheat, and everybody will think of olive oil. Well, the invaders made a start. They planted a lot of olive trees in regions where they would grow, and they had a great time until back in Madrid, the colonial policy wonks said, oh no, they were afraid of the colonists in different parts of their empire, from New Spain to the Caribbean and the Andes, they would develop enough food independence to start trading with each other. And the Spanish wanted a monopoly on all these things, wine grapes and wheat and all the uses of olives. So they destroyed all the trees. And that is why there's been no olive oil in Mexico until very recently, except in Veracruz. And, well, Sorella knows about that. Anyhow, that's some of the background. Oh, I want to say one more thing about the Spanish and lard, which is during the Spanish Inquisition, when they were going around looking at all the people who claimed they had converted from Judaism or Islam, well, they spied on them. Your neighbors spied on you to see whether you were avoiding pork. And people who did not cook with lard came under suspicion. So this is part of why the Spanish were so insistent on using lard.
Isn't that great?
So there was a lard police.
A pork police,
One juncture in history in Mexico. That's awesome.
Well, not in Mexico, but in Spain.
Oh, in Spain. Yeah. Spain.
So Anne asked me the other day, how did your mom use lard at the ranch? And we checked with Socorro. I mean, I remember that she used lard all the time. But Socorro told us something very interesting. She said when she was running low on lard, she would melt 3 kilos of this shortening that was called Inca. she would melt it and then mix it with the lard so it would go further. Mm. And then Anne said, how about the oils? She said, no, the oils were only reserved for salads. Not for cooking. But should we tell them how they
do the lard? Mom, let's talk a little bit about how do you make lard for the home cook? How do you go by that process of extracting the liquid form of fat, right?
Well, there's two ways to do it. You can do it in the oven, which is slower, but it's more pure and easier to control, you know, like at 300, you know, for about 2 hours, something like that. I like to make it on top of the stove. You get unsalted pork.
Could I interrupt? Maybe you should go back to when they slaughtered the pigs and you had all that wonderful fat.
Well, we spent all this time fattening up this pig. We had a very large cattle ranch, and there were outposts, you know, where the cowboys would live with their families to make sure that there weren't any cattle rustlers, mm-hmm. and so they guarded that part. But once around Christmas time, they would kill this pig that they had been feeding lovingly all the scraps of my mother's wonderful cooking. And then all these ladies would come down from the mountain outpost, and we would all get together in the big kitchen that we had at the ranch. And we would cut the fat and have a big tub over wood fire, rendering it to make lard. And it would make the most delicious cracklings, you know, we always left a little bit of meat on it. And I love the meat on it, but Aida, my sister, loved all the fatty part. But we know we made tamales, we made carne adobada, carne con chile colorado, we made morcilla, which I'm not fond of. And then,
blood sausage.
Yes, it was, yes. And then
which is quite delicious, Mom.
I know, but I don't like it. But anyway, so then they would give them one leg of the pork to divide among themselves. And it was just like this really beautiful festive atmosphere there. But in Oaxaca, what they do is, let's say that we want to make it at home. Go get some unsalted pork fat from your butcher. They do sell it separately, but it's very expensive if you buy it like that. And you're gonna cut it. It's hard to cut sometimes. But you can freeze it or make it very cold, and then it's easy to chop up, you know. If you leave the skin on, it'll be very hard to do so. Sometimes it's better to get it without skin. Or, you know, let's say that you're cooking pork at home, cut off all the fat, like from spare ribs or whatever you have, put it in a bag and start saving it. And when you have about a pound or two, you can start rendering it. So you put it on top of the stove by itself and on very low heat until it starts to render. When you have like a certain amount of it, you know, the first part is going to be very clear, white lard. And you're going to pour it out and leave the chicharrones in there, which at this point will be a little bit soft, but not completely soft. And then you cook that until that renders out and it becomes a yellow lard. Manteca María, in Oaxaca, they make this wonderful bread with this lard. But what's really used in Oaxaca is the asiento, which are the little dried pork cracklings and the sediment that's left in the pan and you use that as a spread. And they make this delicious tlayudas, this gigantic tortillas with asiento. And then they put the beans and everything on top. It's like a big pizza.
To be clear, the asiento is basically all the sediment and all the little crispy bits that fall to the bottom of the cauldron or pot when you're rendering your fat. To make lard.
And the last rendering, you have to be very careful because in a second it could burn.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts, Anne?
Well, it always has a soft texture compared to butter. It has a lower melting point. I mean, a higher melting point, so it stays more liquid.
So that's why it's unsaturated.
It's more unsaturated than butter.
Yeah, and also, you know, when you buy lard in the supermarket in the blue package, that has been made to become hard. So they saturate the atoms to make it hard.
Hydrogenated lard is terrible.
So that's you don't want to do that. But the lard that you make at home is two-thirds 2/3 unsaturated, plus it has oleic acid, which is the same thing that olive oil has that helps reduce cholesterol.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in essence, yeah, lard at times can be healthier than butter if you can make
at all times.
You can make the argument. I think you talked a little bit about that beautiful process of butchering the pig and sort of the majesty behind that. Here in Louisiana, where I currently live, they do something called a boucherie, where people in rural parts of Louisiana will slaughter a pig, and you camp out for like 2 days, and there's specific teams that get certain parts of the pig, and they'll make boudin, sausage, or one team will make the cracklings, another team will make, making the gumbo. And it's a very beautiful process. And one of the big parts of that is rendering the fat to make lard. So that sort of tradition also permeates other cultures, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, I love that.
The boucherie.
I'd like to point out something that it's pretty clear to me because of where I live in New Jersey. And it's probably going to be clear to a lot of other people, there are Mexican immigrants coming to this country in spite of the last administration. And wherever you have a big Mexican population, somebody is making lard.
Yeah.
In my part of Jersey, just yesterday in a supermarket, I saw Aztec brand and Mi Ranchito brand Mexican lard. The Aztec is a little ironic since the Aztecs didn't use lard. But it comes in these quart plastic containers, and it's not white. It has a sort of a tan.
Brownish. Yeah.
Tan, light brown color. And you can see a little bit of the cracklings at the bottom.
Yeah. I use that all the time.
I bet that in every part of this country where you have a Mexican community, you can find some brand.
Well, you know, the thing is that you can't make tamales without this lard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because tamales, if you make them with butter, or if you make it with shortening, they're going to be like rocks.
Wait, I've seen you, Sarah, beating up the dough, the masa for the tamales. Could you explain how you do that and how you incorporate the lard?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I first of all, I beat the lard until it's like really, really fluffy. And then I start incorporating that still on the mixer. You could also do it by hand, you know, and then you put your essence in it, you know, which I have to tell that story. But, since we're in the subject, I'll tell you, one time we landed in one of the, all my cousins and everybody would go stay at the ranch for the summer. And one time we happened to stop by the home of one of the husband of Nayo, the manager of the restaurant, el mayordomo. In any case, she said, "Hi, why didn't you let me know that you were coming? I would have done something for you." And I said, "How was I going to let you know? We only had a shortwave radio that you had 8 minutes all day to tell how much rain you had." And so she says, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to make some enchiladas for you, but I'm going to soak the chili and I'm going to now use a blender. I'm going to take the pulp off with my hands and rub it between my hands. And that'll put my essence into this dish. And that is my gift to you."
So that's when you make the masa for the tamales, beating it with your hand.
Yeah, exactly.
Your hand's a better tool, and it puts your essence into it.
Yeah, just really quickly while we're on the subject of tamales, just for everybody, I have a simple recipe that I've learned from you and probably my mama, but for everybody that's listening, a quick, simple recipe for the tamale dough is I've always done 4 cups of masa harina, or maseca or corn flour for tamales. And I use 1 cup of rendered lard, fluffed up, like you said, mom, to 2 cups chicken broth. And that is always a fail-proof recipe. 4 cups of masa, 2 cups of broth, and 1 cup of nice fluffy lard.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And that right there is an automatic recipe that works every time. Okay?
The thing is that Ann used to say that the reason that the lard is necessary for tamales and pastries and everything, because every fat has a different size crystal in it. And lard has the highest crystals. So with tamales, it's an incredible proportion, you know, if you're using masa, because it's like 1 pound of lard to 3 pounds of masa, which is a lot. But you're going to steam them slowly, and most of the fat is going to come out, and you will be left with this wonderful, fluffy corn delicacy that if you made it with any other fat, it would be hard as a rock. Or not, maybe not as a rock, but it would be hard.
Another thing about lard compared to shortenings or vegetable oil, lard has a real flavor of its own.
I agree. And let's talk a little bit about some of the different applications, Mom, because I think we know, let's talk a little bit about when you add lard to beans and it becomes chinito, and how literally the fat rises to the top. Let's talk a little bit about the technique of when you make mole, how you bring all those ingredients together by frying it in lard. And that's that one step that really brings the mole together. Let's talk a little bit about those techniques.
My mom used to make these beans that were like almost like a snack, but they were, you know, she would cook them in lard until they kind of got semi-hard and sort of burst into this, you know, this little flour. And I've tried to duplicate it, and it works, but not with the Rancho Gordo beans that worked the other day. So that's one technique. But the refried beans, if you can't do them with lard, they just don't form that crust that forms on top of the beans, you know. Because in the family, we used to grind up the beans and then cook them with the lard and then put it in the oven. And when you put it in the oven, it forms a crust on the top that's fantastic, you know, with a flour tortilla. It's delicious. And that brings me to the subject of making tortillas. A lot of people like to make tortillas, flour tortillas, with lard.
And let's talk about the mole technique, Mom, why that's important.
Well, because it melts all the flavors together, you know. I mean, most moles have like 27 ingredients, the real party moles. There are a lot of them that are very simple, and they don't have that. But what happens is that every ingredient that's going to go in there is going to be processed separately. It might be sautéed, or it might be
in lard.
It would be in lard, but everything is then toasted, you know, and then put together. So everything is done separately, which is one of the things that creates all the layers of flavor in mole. You know, so if you have a teaspoon of mole, you taste it and it tastes like one thing, but the next one's going to taste like another, because it's all layers of flavor. So that's why it's so, so very important in moles and other sauces.
Yeah, it brings together the flavors.
Yeah.
And let's also talk about lard as a preservation medium, right? Because, you know, you look in England, they do potted shrimp where they're basically, and potted beef, where they're taking, you know, cooked protein, putting it into a jar, and then covering it with a layer of butter or fat as a preservative. Is there a tradition of using lard in that same regard?
I don't think so. In Mexico, no? I don't see it. Do you think so, Anne?
I don't think so. I don't think they did that kind of preservation. Of course, in Southwest France, making confit, pork confit, lard is the only thing you would use. I mean, there are traditions of lard everywhere that people raised pigs all over the world. They use lard a lot. Well, they used to in China before the food police started saying, oh, no. Italy, it's a tremendously important fat in Italy.
Strutto.
Strutto. And many parts of France, Hungary, well, you know George Lang, who did that wonderful Hungarian cookbook, and the renowned restaurateur. And he used to sing the praises of lard.
Mm. Before we forget, George Lang had the absolute best quote ever about the restaurant business. Mm-hmm. He said, The restaurant business has gone the way of prostitution. It's full of amateurs.
And remember, George would call everybody darling, remember? He'd be like, hi, darling.
No, I don't remember.
It didn't matter if you were a male or a female. George would call, hello, darling. Always impeccably dressed, amazing man. Of course, we're talking about George Lang, the owner of Café des Artistes in New York City in the Upper West Side. Amazing, amazing man who did so much for our industry. So I know he's down there listening to this podcast upstairs, having a nice little Bordeaux, laughing at all of us right now. Mm-hmm. So wonderful.
Well, I was just thinking there are cookies that you used to make, Sorella.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The Christmas.
You know, crisp and short. What do they call those?
Bizcochitos. Bizcocho.
Bizcochos?
B-I-Z-C-O-C-H-O.
But not polvorones, right, Mom? Different from polvorones.
Yeah, polvorones I usually made with butter and very finely chopped nuts. Oh, I love those. You know, the problem is that those are things that I love to have. But I don't make them because if I make them, I eat them all. You know, and it's just like, I'm only going to eat two today. I put them away again. I don't know how it goes. I'll get another three. Then finally, by the third day, I say, I'm just going to eat them all right now so I don't have to worry about temptation.
Was it in the Oaxacan cookbook that you had these little sort of cookie-like, maybe they had cornmeal?
Pemoles,
yeah.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you made those?
Those were done with mazarina. And I think it has canela, lard, and, you know, flour. No, I don't think it has flour. Maybe, no, it doesn't have flour. But what's really good about it, what I like to do for that is to toast the corn and let it dry and then grind the corn and make it into a version of that cookie, and it's kind of crunchy and it just has a totally different texture of anything else that, you know, that people have. I love it. And remember that I think it was called Bitiwinge in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, they make this tiny little tamales in a circle, you know, with lard and dried shrimp.
This episode is brought to you by Honeycomb Credit. Heritage Radio Network listeners can learn more about the power of community capital by visiting honeycombcredit.com/HRN. We all know that food businesses like yours are the backbone of your community. You make your neighborhood a more delicious place to be, and your customers are hungry for more. Food businesses across the country are working with Honeycomb to open new locations, buy equipment, and grow. You too can unlock fair growth capital by allowing your community to invest directly into your business. A crowdfunded loan from Honeycomb deepens your customer relationships and gives them a whole new way to engage with your business. You'll also get access to thousands of local investors in the Honeycomb network who are passionate about seeing food businesses succeed. Honeycomb is the community bank of the 21st century. Fair rates, flexible terms, and no prepayment penalties. Honeycomb has proven to be an invaluable growth tool for all kinds of businesses, from James Beard-nominated restaurants and upstart food trucks to organic farms and award-winning breweries. Best of all, with Honeycomb, you're paying back your neighbors, not big banks. To learn more about how Honeycomb Credit can help grow your business while building vibrant, financially empowered neighborhoods, visit honeycombcredit.com/HRN.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. Just Egg is now the fastest-growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based consumers in your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/HRN. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat. And it's more sustainable, Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/HRN. Just Egg makes a delicious, plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also frozen, pre-baked, folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andreas calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, "It's so good, I feel guilty eating it." Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/HRN.
I think a good thing to delineate and also kind of distinguish is the idea of tallow, because I think now the fats are being more widespread and people have a stronger grip and understanding of different fats. Let's talk a little bit about what tallow is in reference to into like the traditional lard that we're talking about. So tallow, from my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, and it's the fat that surrounds the kidneys, right? It's like a particular kind of fat, or no? Am I incorrect in saying that? So how would you describe tallow?
Beef fat.
Well, I think that there are different kinds of lard, that is pig lard, pork lard. And there's a especially good one that is used a lot for baking, especially. I don't know whether in Mexico so much, but in French cuisine. And that's the fat from around the kidney of the pig. But tallow is really beef fat.
Yeah.
That you render in the same way. And I think that, I'm trying to remember, there was this scandal maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, at the height of the food police coming down on everyone. It was discovered that McDonald's fried their famous French fries in tallow.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the horror.
The horror.
I had to stop. But I don't think it's a big tradition in Mexico.
No.
No.
But tallow, just for everyone that's out there, is if you ever had a Jamaican patty, those wonderful little pastries from Jamaica, the crust is and the dough is made with tallow. And that's why it's so beautiful and buttery and rich and
crisp.
Yes, and crisp.
Yeah.
So we talked a little bit about tallow. It's derivative of beef, obviously. We understand that, you know, the idea of rendering lard is a process. It's something that is essential because it has such a big impact on flavor, right? Are there any other kind of fats that out there, animal fats or anything else that we should bring up? I think that's a really good part. You know, we're talking about, you know, olive oil, right? We talked a little bit about tallow, lard. I think it's interesting to mention that, you know, you talked, Anne, a little bit about olive oil and how important that is. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that usually when a region grows wine, there's always olives grows kind of next to it, right? And I think that's kind of interesting. And we'll talk a little bit about, you said, you know, the Spaniards brought olive groves, they brought Venus vinifera, they brought pork, horses, all these things to the New World. I just think it's interesting to kind of touch upon that.
But somehow, after they'd got done destroying the olive trees, people in Mexico didn't cook so much with olive oil unless it was imported from Spain. And very expensive, you know. It was sort of like the Americans fighting over the tea tax of the British. And somehow Veracruz, which is this long, skinny state, if you look on the map of Mexico, along the Caribbean coast.
The Gulf Coast.
The Gulf Coast.
Yeah, not the Caribbean.
And it was It had big trade with Cuba. It had big trade all throughout the Caribbean. And maybe that's why they maintained more of a tradition of cooking with olive oil in Veracruz than any place else.
Well, there's a dish that everybody can make, can have camarones al ajillo. Anything al ajillo, you make kind of like a mixer of olive oil and then a little bit of salt and maybe some and crushed, lots of crushed garlic, not chopped, but crushed very thoroughly in some salt. And then when I discovered, there was this restaurant called Pardiños in Mexico City, and they had this camarones al ajillo that were amazing. And we went every day to try to get the recipe, every day to try to get the recipe. I mean, for 4 days, I finally asked the guy, do you have to go in there? They asked the waiter, go in there and see how they make it. And he said, pues le ponen rosa blanca. Rosa blanca is this chicken consomme cubes, like, you know, like the North Swiss thing. So they make this marinade with a North Swiss little chicken consomme thing. And then they mix it with olive oil and slices of red chili, dried red chili, and slices of the Anaheim or whatever you happen to have in hand. And you can make anything with it. You can make fish fillets. You can do shrimp. You can make vegetables. There's mushrooms in particular, you know, are very, very, very famous for dishes, you know, with al ajillo. So I think olive oil is used a lot. There's an interesting kind of thing that they do in Oaxaca, because lard is so expensive. What they do is that they chop very, very thinly a bunch of onions, and they get vegetable oil and cook it very, very slowly until the onions almost disintegrate. Then they strain it, and that is an incredibly flavored oil, you know. And then they strain it, and they use that for sauteing, you know, like beans and everything else. Because if they can't afford either lard or vegetable oil, olive oil.
And I don't think there's nothing wrong with flavoring a lard, like how you would make a flavored oil, right? I think, you know, I always like when I'm cooking, if I'm making carnitas, and I'm putting in a little bit of spices into that or chile, I like to reserve that fat and use that as a cooking medium down the road a little bit. Because I think it only gets better, you know?
Well, they use annatto oil for that, achiote. Yeah.
Well, I know, Mom, but I'm talking about carnitas. Like anything that you're cooking in fat or confit, you want to reserve that and use that as something down the road that you can always kind of dip into your larder for.
Yeah, yeah.
So to speak.
Yeah, exactly. No pun intended, right? That was for you, Anne.
Now, the other day, Sarah and I, we were talking about Mexican cooking fats, and I was asking a lot of questions about the ranch and about how your grandmother made butter.
Oh, yeah.
You churned your own butter.
Yeah, we did.
On the ranch.
And you know, they would bring the big pails of, you know, that was like one of my favorite things, because I was a little cowgirl, and I would wait every morning on the fence, sitting there with my bridle in my hand, until the cowboy would come down with a remuda, which were all the horses that were out overnight, and then bring them into the corral. But by then, all the cows were waiting to be milked. You know, that was a lot of mooing or whatever they do. And then Lupe would had a little stool, and she would put a cup of pot of coffee in those enamelware, you know, blue and white things, and bring the big and the sock, you know, the sock, I don't know if it's a sock, but it looks like a sock, but and then you put the coffee in there.
Oh, the coffee sock, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then, so then she would do that. She'd make us this big. We had this huge cups, and then we would go directly to the tit and squeeze, you know, all the milk directly into it, and it would form like a cappuccino.
Forms.
So it was delicious. So then they would bring the milk to the well, they would distribute it, but they would bring it to the house and leave it outside, which was interesting, what Paula mentioned yesterday. That, you know, so in any case, so it, this crust would form on the top, which is all the fat, and they would, my mom would take that.
Natas.
Las natas. You know, what, those cookies that they make in Mexico City with natas, they're just to die.
If the milk is rich and the milk is unhomogenized, that cream layer will come to the top. And if it's really rich milk, it'll be a very thick, textured, creamy layer. That's your natas.
And that's what is used to churn the butter.
Did you have a churn?
Yeah, we had a churn. And a churner.
So it was like the traditional, you had like something tall, right, Mom? Like a little
No,
vessel.
Not that tall. About maybe 12 inches long or maybe 15 inches high. And then like about 8 inches wide or more. And then there was this paddle it was part, there were wood, and there were two or three pieces of wood on this thing that you would turn until the fat was separated. There were no food processors at that time. But in any case, it was just like really, really fast to do, and it was so delicious.
So you worked salt into the butter?
Yeah. And you know, the other thing is that we forgot another use for lard. When we had the newly made lard, or even the old one, when they were making corn tortillas, we'd love to go spread it on the tortilla and put a little bit of salt and maybe some salsa and eat that with that instead of butter, with the lard. It was delicious.
Divine. Something so simple. Something that connects the land, you know, the corn with the animal. And I think it's very symbolic when you think about lard and how it affects Mexican cuisine, because it is the number one utilized cooking fat in Mexico. And the tradition has not been lost. I think nowadays you have all these young people that are preserving the traditional food ways, like honoring the animal by utilizing all the different cuts and making lard and making sure that's all that custom and that tradition is preserved. I think it's beautiful.
Do you think it's under threat?
Yeah. And, you know, and Anne, you talked about the invaders. I love that. I think there's like a conspiracy. People are coming down on you, Anne, for all the things that you love. You know, there's a lard police. We got invaders. We got people coming down on you, Anne, about as far as changing the food ways. But we're going to stay strong. We're not going to let anybody impede what we're trying to get done here, which is, you know, obviously talking about these wonderful Mexican ingredients and making sure that they're recognized and celebrated.
That's great, honey. don't tell me it's already time to go.
I think we're almost there, Mom.
Well, I had a question about you, for you two guys.
Okay.
I had forgotten to mention that one of the sources of fat in Mexican diets before the Spanish invaders was squash seeds, all kinds of squashes. And this brings us back to when we were talking about squashes a year ago on the same program. Well, anyhow, you make pepian out of pumpkin seeds or squash seeds. And nowadays, of course, they do it using lard. But it used to be that the only fat came from the pipianas, the seeds themselves. So you, Sarah, when you were working on the Oaxaca book, you got a recipe from a Zapotec woman for a pipian. Without any added fat, except the pumpkin seeds. Mm. And I don't know whether you have ever tried anything like that, Aaron.
No, so basically what you're saying is that you extract the pumpkin seed oil, in essence, and that was, at one point, that was the cooking fat there.
Mm.
No or no?
Not a separate cooking fat. You crushed them.
Gotcha.
But the thing is that In Yucatan, they make this tacos with egg, with hard-boiled egg. And what do they call it? It starts with an M. In any case, it's going to go in a pumpkin seed sauce. And what they do is they grind up the seeds and mix it with water and continue to manipulate it until the oil is extracted. And they take that oil and use it to decorate the tacos. You know, it has a tomato sauce, and then they take the oil, which is green, and they drop little drops on top of every dish. But it's a lot of work to make, and you could just buy pumpkin oil now, pumpkin seed oil.
And before we conclude, please let everybody know how they can reach out to you and engage you in all things awesome food related, because we want everyone to use you as a resource. All of our guests, we've had an unbelievable distinguished lineup, and we just want to make sure that people can reach out to you. How will they do that?
I guess my email is probably the best way.
Mm-hmm.
It's Anne, at annemendelson.com.
Wow. Awesome.
Before we close, I just want to tell them, one time I got together this group of people on how to do research. And it was like, it was Russ Parsons, who did how to ask the science question of where to find the answer, and did navigating the historical record. This was before the internet got so big. And I did How to Penetrate a Culture. It was a hit, and it was amazing to be. One of the things that I love about working with Anne is that she knows so much. And every fact that's in all my books and everything, I know she has. I mean, we've had discussions about this. Well, are you sure that there's a comma there? You know.
Sorella supplied all the real knowledge.
Well, but it's nothing. It's like getting a lot of beautiful fabric and not knowing what to do with it.
Absolutely. And we know the value, my mom and I, of having an unbelievable co-writer. You know, my memoir that just came out, you know, Where I Come From, Life Lessons from a Latino Chef, Steph mm-hmm. Ferrari, was invaluable through guiding me through this process and capturing my voice. So we understand how important it is to have a team member, a compatriot in this process where you're really exposing yourself. And it can't be done without someone like you, Anne, for my mom. And I know, you know, and we appreciate you so much for all that.
Thank you. Thank you, Avalon. But I have to thank both of you. And I have to thank Sarah for anything I know about Mexican food and for just enlarging my palate. Well, not just through the restaurant. But you and I used to sit in your kitchen, and I would be watching you cook, and we would be saying, was that 2 tablespoons or 3 tablespoons?
Yeah.
Or why did you add that before this?
Yeah, so that's why my recipes are so perfect, because Anne wrote them, and they're absolutely perfect. I can write it now, but the first book, I mean, she was like a colonel there.
Yeah. Very meticulous and
it was stern.
Yeah.
And stern. Well, anyway, it was a wonderful afternoon chat here with my dear, dear friend, the brilliant Anne Mendelsohn, and my gorgeous son, who was such a good director of this podcast. It's just lots of fun to get a chance to talk to you so closely like this. It's beautiful. So thank you so much for joining us, Anne, I'll say goodbye, and then Aaron will say goodbye. And
yes. Well, thank you so much. And again, we've been talking here on Cooking in Mexican from A to Z with the wonderful, all-knowing Anne Mendelsohn, who's, again, like my tia, like my aunt. I've known her forever, and she has been somebody that's someone I can always lean on as a motherly figure, maternal figure, and just somebody that I admire so much. So I'm so happy that we're able to have Anne share her knowledge with us here on this particular episode where we're talking about lard and other cooking fats. It's been unreal to have you, Anne. We thank you so much. I hope all of you guys have enjoyed this episode of Cooking in Mexican from A to Z on Heritage Radio Network. Please stay tuned. We have a bunch of amazing guests coming down the pipe, and I hope you guys stay tuned and stay interested. Muchísimas gracias.
Hasta luego.
Hasta luego. Thank you, Anne.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simple Cast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.